Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to Golf Talk Live. I'm your host, Ted Odorico, and glad to be here tonight on Thursday, the first day of the U.S. Open here in 2014. Looking forward to a lot of great action happening on day one. Unfortunately, I didn't get to see any of it, but nevertheless, we'll try and plug in through the weekend and see hopefully a good U.S. Open. But tonight, thanks for tuning in to Golf Talk Live. We've got another great round of Coach's Corner. I've got a great panel, some of which, of course, have been on. In fact, all of them have been on here before. We're going to start with my favorite person to throw under the bus, of course, Clint Wright, PGA Teacher Professional, and he's a 30-year member, in fact, of the PGA, and he's also at R3 Golf Academy up in Pendleton, South Carolina. And if you want to learn a little bit more about Clint and the R3 Golf Academy, you can check them out at www.tgmgolf.com. Also joining the panel tonight is Greg Liberto. And, of course, he's been on the panel before and interviewed him a little while back. And he's an experienced speaker, coach, and writer, and has a great perspective of the game, unlike really anybody else in the business. He's got over 15 years of research, and with that research, he's developed programs that will show you how to become your best. That's why they call him the head coach. And you can check him out at theheadcoach.us. And, of course, rounding out the panel tonight is also my guest this evening. A little bit later on, I'm going to be talking with Scott Millman. He's a master teaching professional, and he's the owner and president of The Simple World of Golf and also co-owner and founder of the Millman NRG Foundation. We'll talk to him a little bit later in the program about that. And he's going to be joined by another gentleman by the name of Gary Tanner a little bit later in the show as well. But, gentlemen, welcome back to Coach's Corner.
Great to be here.
Thanks, Ted.
Thanks, all right. Ted. Appreciate it. Appreciate it. Thanks, guys, for taking some time to be on here. And I know everybody's eager to see what's going to happen. As we were talking off air, there, of course, a few of us here hadn't had a chance to really keep up to speed on what was going on the first day of the Open. So I'm sure we're going to be looking forward to checking out some of the highlights a little bit later on. But everybody's, I think, now familiar with how the Coach's Corner segment works, so I don't need to read all that out again. But for those of you that are tuning in here, don't forget we're live on Golf Talk Live every Thursday evening at 6 p.m. Central Time, right through till 8 p.m. The first hour, of course, is the Coach's Corner. And if you want to call in at any time during the program, we certainly would love to hear from you. You can do so at area code 4667, pardon me. Or you can email questions to ted.golftalklive@gmail.com. And if you want to get updates for the show, you can do so on social media on Facebook. Just check out Golf Talk Live blog and throw a few likes while you're there as well. I appreciate it. And, of course, you can follow me on Twitter at TedandBuckCEO. That CEO is in caps. And you can also check out the Golf Talk Live website at www.golftalkliveblog.com. Okay, guys, let's start off. And the topic tonight was sent in from Jerry by Little Rock, out in Little Rock, Arkansas, excuse me. And his question was actually very simple. It was when to take the risk. And let me just read a little bit of his email here, and we'll go from there. His question to the panel tonight is one of timing. He says he plays pretty regularly in the club championship, and often he's faced with make this decision. He says, do I go for it or do I lay back? Sometimes he can't decide what to do. He usually tries to go with his gut instincts, but sometimes that doesn't work. So his question is, of course, when to take the risk. And I hear the bus rolling up the street, so I know that Clint's going to go first tonight. So, Clint, yeah. When should Jerry what should Jerry do here and in a situation like that? He's playing his club championship, and how does he know when to take the risk and maybe when he needs to be a little bit more conservative?
Well, you know, it would also depend on whether he's playing a match play or whether it's stroke play.
Mm-hmm.
if he's playing match play, a lot of that's going to be dictated by what his opponent has done or what he thinks his opponent's going to do, to whether to take the risk to maybe put a little pressure on the player, or maybe he's got nothing to lose but by going for the real difficult shot to try to make something up. If it's stroke play, I think it's again a circumstance where do you stand now? Mm-hmm. Is it the first day of the tournament? Is it the last day of the tournament? What's the circumstances on whether you take it? But I always tried to tell a person that I want them to play the shot that they're guaranteed success with.
Right.
Play the shot that they know they can pull off. If they're in trouble, if he's talking about a risky shot from like through the trees, under the trees, over the trees, you know, that's get it back out and play. And, you know, to me, like you always hear, let your wedge do some work for you. Get the ball back and play. You know, if it's that shot over the water on a risk reward par five, yeah, I think you just got to be guaranteed that you got that shot in your bag. It's not a, you know, I've heard it said many ways. If you know that you got 230 yards in your three wood and you're 230 yards away, you might want to lay it up short and let your wedge work again.
Yeah.
You know, but if you're 210 and, you know, you can get it there, go for it. But it's one thing I would want to feel like I'm going to be 100% successful with the shot I'm taking, or I'm going to let my wedge and putter do the work for me.
Great answer, and I agree 100% with that. I think that you have to, you know, if you've got a go-to shot and that fits within your arsenal at the time, that particular shot, you know, then certainly I think you can go for it. But again, it depends on the circumstances in the tournament that you're playing, and as you said, whether it's a stroke or match play. Greg, let's flip this around a little bit more, and let's take this from sort of the in the head, if you will, as opposed to the physical part of the game. What are some thoughts that maybe a player needs to really let go and absorb through his head before he makes that decision? What are some things that he needs to be thinking about, or she, for that matter?
Sure. Yeah, and I'm going to probably piggyback on what Clint said to some extent as well. You know, it's so much of it is really it depends on, you know, what you're referring to specifically and what that situation is. But I'm a pretty conservative, I guess, person as a whole, Ted, and I'm, you know, I always tell my students, it's, you know, it's again kind of referring to what Clint said. It's, you know, if you're undecided as to what two clubs to hit, you know, I like to make things a little bit more tangible and say, okay, I know if I have a 3-iron in my hand, my likelihood for success is about a 6 out of 10. But I know if I put an 8-iron in my hand and I make a little bit wiser choice and my confidence level is about a 9 out of 10, I'm probably going to be more inclined to go with the second choice, you know, for a variety of reasons. But, you know, most importantly is, you know, we always have to remember what the objective of the game is, which is to get the ball in the hole as fast as possible. And you might say, well, if I take a riskier shot, my likelihood for getting the ball in the hole is better. But at the same time, you have to be smart and say, okay, let's just talk about the percentages. You know, let's just erase everything else out of the equation. Let's just talk about the percentage of me, the highest percentage of likelihood of me hitting a successful shot, and that's going to be with a particular club as opposed to high risk, high reward. I've never really, you know, there are certain situations where you do maybe take a risk, and a lot of that might be because you're pressing, which again is a bad thing from a thought perspective. So there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of factors and maybe unknowns and variables in the whole equation here, but the bottom line is that, you know, I'm a big proponent of playing smart, playing safer, playing the percentages, and giving yourself the greatest opportunity to, you know, to get the ball in the hole.
Yeah, and that's a great approach as well. And you know, I think that it really depends on the individual. If somebody's a little more conservative, as you indicated, Greg, I think they may want to you know, look at the percentages of and likelihood of them executing the shot and maybe taking that 8-iron as opposed to trying to hit the 3-iron. Scott, I want to bring you in here, but I want to, you know, just modify it a little bit. Obviously, pressure is a factor, and as Jerry had indicated in the in his email here, you know, he plays in his club championship quite a bit. So there's a little bit more of a pressure situation as opposed to if he's just playing a, you know, a weekend foursome where he can maybe be a little bit more aggressive. But let's look at it from that perspective. You know, in a pressure situation and maybe a little bit more, is that going to make a big difference, do you think, in the choice that Jerry might make?
I think it makes a huge difference in the choice that he's going to make. But then again, it goes back to what Greg and Clint already said. You know, you've got to have that go-to shot. And one of the things at that point when you're under pressure, and we all know this, is having a reliable pre-shot routine that you can go to so you're not necessarily worrying about the pressure or worrying about the outcome. You worry about your routine, picking out that smallest target, whether it's a leaf on a tree or a specific spot in the fairway, and you're playing to that spot and eliminating the outcome aspect of it and just focusing on the process. We hear that a lot. You know, the tour players are under pressure all the time, and they focus on the shot at hand, eliminating the pressure situation. And again, as far as taking risks, I'm with Greg. I'm going to go kind of more the conservative route, you know, maybe in a pressure situation where, you know, I know that if I'm under pressure, I might tighten up a little bit and the swing gets a little shorter and I might block a shot out to the right. You know, maybe it's easier to control the 8-iron versus a 3-iron at that point in time, and we play a little more conservatively.
Yeah. And I think, too, and by the way, that was also a great answer. You know, they're obviously in a lot of these questions that were a million variables that can happen in scenarios. And I think it depends on the level, skill level of the player. I mean, obviously the tour players can take a little more risk because they're confident in the types of shots they're able to execute. And most of them, of course, if not all of them, have their go-to shots. But obviously, you know, and let me ask you, three of you, and you can yes or no or expand if you want. That's obviously going to be, when you're teaching your students, that's going to be a factor as well in giving them some advice for when they play, you know, whether it be with their friends or in a tournament of some sort. Their skill level is going to dictate really how you're going to advise them in a situation like that. Would that be correct, Clint?
Yeah, I mean, I think that comes back to the kind of the way I've phrase it is I want them to play the shot that they can be 100% successful with. So that's going to be dictated by their skill level. I mean, if you can hit it, you know, through a 2-foot hole, I mean, that skill level is obviously very high versus needing a, you know, a Greyhound bus hole to hit it through. You know? So it all comes down to that, you know, as plain as it can be. I mean, so your skill level is going to dictate what 100% will be. You know, so if I'm a tour player, I'm going to play a shot that I'm going to be successful with 90% of the time, where the guy out there shooting 85 is going to be successful with it maybe 20% of the time. So skill
right.
level
so
has everything to do with it.
Right. Greg, you agree, disagree, or want to add anything to that?
Oh, I totally agree. And, you know, another thing that Scott had pointed out is, you know, there's the whole – aspect of pressure now when you're playing in a club championship that comes into the equation. And, you know, again, if you're just going back to the sheer percentages of the shot and you say, you know, yeah, I'm, you know, 50% confident in making this shot, well, that goes down quite a bit when you're playing in a competitive situation like a club championship or, you know, a major competitive event, because your grip tightens, you think differently, your swing changes ever so slightly, and as a result, now when you have that shot that, you know, maybe you're not 100% confident with, that number, whatever it is typically going to go down from a confidence perspective when you're playing under pressure situation. So again, I'm just going to go back to really what we're all saying is just make the wise choice and go with whatever club feels the best in your hand. And, you know, I have a real simple saying of, if there's ever a doubt, there's no doubt. So if you're kind of questioning
right.
as to whether or not you should go for it, the answer is no.
There you go.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great answer. And, you know, Scott, let me just, you know, add this and get you to chime in, if you will, real quick, and then I want to move on. You know, obviously, again, the skill level is going to dictate a lot. But, you know, if somebody just wants to go out and have some fun and then maybe they want to be a little bit more aggressive, even if it's one of the higher handicappers that you're working with, Obviously, the bottom line is, you know, as Greg and we all know, we want to get the ball in the hole as quick as possible and the fewest number of strokes. But there comes a point in time when you just want to go out and have some fun and maybe take a little more risk. So if somebody came to you and said, look, I just want to play with my foursome, but sometimes I get a little skittish on these types of shots, if there's not really a lot of risk as far as, you know, money or what have you at hand, then go for it. Would that be
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Why not?
Yeah, every time.
Honestly, the one thing missing from our game now is guys going out and having fun. I think you look at somebody like a Bubba Watson and why he draws the crowd that he draws. Is I think, you know, from a teaching standpoint, I think a lot of times we get wrapped up in the mechanics and perfect swings and swing planes and all the aspects, and I think we lose the ability to have fun. And to touch on that point, a lot of times I'll send my students out with one club and say, go play nine holes from the red tees with a 4-iron and go have fun and see what you can do. So absolutely go out and try it. Even if you know the percentages are really low, what's the harm in trying it? Because that 1 out of 10 times or 2 out of 10 times that you hit that shot and you pull it off, that's what gets you back for the next round of golf.
Well, and it also gives you some bragging rights with your buddies if you pull it off. If you don't, well, then you're going to be the butt of every joke in the 19th hole. But if you pull it off, you know, then you got some bragging rights for the next few weekends. But great answers, guys. And I agree 100% across the board with all that's been said so far. I think that's right on. I think it depends on the circumstances. It depends, you know, on the skill level, of course. But ultimately, we want everybody to go out there and have fun and have a good time. All right, I want to move on to our next question here. And this is from Keith from Atlanta. And two reasons why I picked this. And one, he obviously has a little bit of a sense of humor in it. But also, it was pertaining to the U.S. Open. He starts it off here and he says, I think since this week is the U.S. Open week, and I'm sure that the USGA will put all the stops out for the guys on tour, that I would ask this question. But first, let me paint the scenario. He says, the course I play often has pretty slick greens. He says, I think the greenskeeper is a bit sadistic and enjoys making the members work harder for birdies. So he's obviously that plays a course with a, as he said, a greenskeeper that's maybe a little sadistic and probably has a sense of humor. But anyways, he says, how do I putt fast greens? So, Greg, I'm going to jump to you first this time. You know, this is something that not everybody's faced with, of course, but obviously in the U.S. Open, these guys are going to be putting on some pretty quick greens this week, I suspect, just to ratchet it up a little bit. So let's put together some ideas and maybe some thought process on what guys Keith here needs to do about putting on some fast, slick greens.
Yeah, you know, it's probably a few different answers for this one, Ted. I think, you know, one of the things that I think is pertinent here is a concept that I teach, which is to stand over the hole before you putt. You know, if you have a 12-foot or whatever, you look back and you see the line of, you know, what type of a putt you're going to hit, right to left, left to right, straight putt, whatever it might be. And I actually stand over the hole first after I sized up, you know, what the ball is going to do, and I identify the very specific blade of grass where I envision the ball is going to enter the hole. And what that does is it not only gets you very specific with where your spot is, but once you go back to the ball and you're standing over your putt and you don't see that blade of grass because you're too far away from it now, but you know exactly, you're very specific and in tune with where that ball is going to enter the hole. And what that does, it eliminates negative swing thoughts. It eliminates the thought of, you know, don't leave it short, don't blow it past because these greens are running so fast. So that simple concept of getting focused on a very specific blade of grass is very helpful when you're playing on greens that are either really slow or really fast, because your tendency is to be so concerned with the speed that you lose sight of the objective, again, which is to put the ball in the hole. So identifying a very specific blade of grass where the ball will enter the hole is going to have you more relaxed over the putt and have you thinking properly.
Right, and that is 100% correct on that. I agree totally. Clint, let me ask you, again, rephrasing it just a little bit differently, if I may. You know, there's a lot, I'm sure a lot of different techniques and things, but if you were dealing with a student, let's say in the next little while, that maybe is going to be playing in the tournament or something, that, and this is going to be one of his obstacles to work with some fast greens, what are some, do you have any specific drills or things that you might have them work on to help them out a little bit? Anything specific you can think of?
Well, you know, there's a lot of things that you can do, but, you know, if you're thinking about if the greens are that fast where they become the obstacle, okay, then you can take the humorous approach here and say, well, you just got to keep it below the hole. I mean, you know, that's and that makes putting fast greens a lot easier. But, you know, I'll be honest, I think the guys will also agree that I would much rather as a player putt on fast greens than I would slow greens.
Yep.
And I think you got to get a person believing that. Is, look, this is the type of greens I want to putt on. You know, I think Gary Player may have said it the best. He said, you know, is that you got to love what you're playing on. You know, if you got fast greens this week, I love putting on fast greens. If it's slow greens, I love putting on slow greens. You have to take an attitude to it. Says, look, I love these greens the way they are. I'm going to try to figure out how to make them an advantage for me, that I don't have to hit the ball to the hole. I've got to feed the ball to the hole. And I would get a person, you know, working on just trying to feed the ball to the hole to get a sense of that being their putting philosophy. Most likely I would spend a lot of time with the players, obviously lag putting from the 25 and 30 feet, because if the greens are that quick, the ball is going to release out when it hits the green. It's going to roll out a little further, so it's going to be a little tougher to get the ball in closer to the hole. So you're probably going to have a lot of those 25 and 30-foot lag putts. But most importantly, if I'm getting one of my players ready for a competition, in that case, I'm going to make sure that they got a little bit of ball control from around the greens. To when they're pitching the ball, they miss the green. I want to pitch the ball where they've got an uphill putt. So I need them to have a little bit more control over their chipping and pitching game in order to position the ball better. So a little of that. I'd have them learn how to feed the ball to the hole, a little bit softer approach. But most importantly, get them thinking, hey, these are the greens I want to play on.
Yeah, and I like that. Yeah, I like that answer because I remember, you know, hearing that that Gary Player had said that, and that's so true. I think a lot of it, you know, golf is so much, you know, it's not just the physical part. I think too many people put a lot of emphasis, and I'm talking about, you know, the average player out there, puts too much emphasis on the physical side of the game and really not enough on what goes on upstairs in the head. And I heard something really interesting the other day when I did the women's program that I do now every Tuesday morning, and Cindy Miller, of course, is doing a great series called Own Your Game, and she was talking about really about narrow and wide focus and how a lot of the tour players, as an example, you know, when they're getting ready for a specific shot, of course, their focus will narrow, much like what Greg was talking about on that, you know, blade of grass and watching the ball feed into the hole. But then when they're away from that shot, they sort of take it away from the pressures at hand and sort of, you know, for lack of a better word, smell the flowers as they're walking around the golf course. And I think that's so important. I think too many, and what I would say to Keith as an example, and Scott, I'm going to bring you in as to chime in as well, but, you know, I think sometimes if you sort of preset your thought process that the greens are fast and, you know, sort of let that be your thought of the day, it's going to add to the pressure of the round, I believe, anyways. I might be wrong. Scott, would you agree with that? Or
I think getting to the aspect of that you're worrying about what the conditions are, you know, it's kind of like when it rains, if you have a thought process of that's going to eliminate half the field and, you know, you do well in the rain, it's kind of like what Clint and Greg were already touching base on. You know, I get, you know, my students are prepping for tournaments, especially my juniors. You know, the last thing we worry about is having them worry about what the conditions are or aren't going to be. You know, they could be practicing on fast greens the day before, the day of. It rains and the greens slow down and they've got to adjust again. So there's so many variables that go into it that, you know, you can only prepare so much. You've just got to be able to have the right attitude to make that adjustment. And it doesn't matter what the circumstances are. I say to myself, hey, if the greens are fast today, you know what, I'll make the adjustment. And, you know, let's face it, there are just some days that you just don't make the adjustment. You just can't quite get the speed. You don't feel you're not reading the breaks properly, and you just, you know what, you do the best you can on that given day, and you move forward. But like Clint said, at a certain point, if I know we're playing on fast screens, I'm going to set tees at maybe 20, 30, 40, and 50 feet, and I'm going to practice my lag putting from those distances, and I'm going to maybe put a tee or the flag behind the hole or maybe another club 3 feet beyond the hole, and I'm going to try and get, you know, each putt to go beyond the front edge of the cup but stop short of that flag or make it, if the case may be, and really
right.
concentrate on the feel for those distances, and that should help.
Yeah,
I just want to kind of back up something really important that Clint had mentioned, really with not just this situation with fast greens, but you know what Scott was alluding to, you know, whether it's raining or whatever, the key component to all of this is you have to embrace it, because so many players say, oh, I hate fast greens, or I'm terrible on fast greens. Well, if that's your thought process going into that tournament, you're done. Because what you're going to be doing is you're going to be fighting it the whole time. So you, regardless of your skill set or your past performance or what you think, you have to basically say to yourself, I love putting on fast greens.
Yeah.
Whether you do or you don't, you have to basically just embrace
it
just go out and do the best you can.
Well, and that's so true, guys. You know, the thing is, if you go in with a negative thought like that, you've pretty much set yourself up for failure. And that's in everything in life. It's not just in golf, but it's everywhere in life. If you automatically, you know, go in with that sort of negative thought, and it's much like, you know, and obviously you have to be realistic. You know, let's take away from the greens for a second, but. You know, obviously when you're stepping up on the tee, you know, you're looking out there and you're seeing the bunkers, you're seeing maybe a lake, a pond or what have you, or out of bounds. And obviously you have to be cognizant of these things that go on. But I think if you go in there with the mindset of, gosh, look at all this trouble out there, you've already set yourself up for failure. And, you know, I think this is where, you know, somebody that's a little more focused, and this is why the tour players, I think, it's not just the fact that they can hit the ball better, but you know, they're able to focus and eliminate a lot of that trouble. They're aware that it's there, but they're not focusing on it. And that's where the high handicapper has the opposite effect. They're focusing on the trouble and not about the task at hand. So it, you know, it creeps in, and I understand, you know, exactly, Greg, what you're getting at.
You know, Greg, let me add one thing. One of the things that I talked to the folks about there, and you're right, Ted, is that, you know, the golf course is nothing more than a playing field.
That's
so.
Right.
The best players concentrate on their game, which means what their body's doing and the shots they're playing.
Mm-hmm.
They don't worry about the playing field. That would be just like a batter in baseball worrying about the baseball field.
Yeah,
they're not worried about the field. They're just worried about the ball coming at them.
Yeah,
you know. So we all get tight, you know, like the bunkers and whatever. Everybody gets tight. And again, it comes back to those fast greens. You know, that's the playing field. So if you get focused in on the playing field, there's no way you're going to focus and concentrate on what you need to do in order to play that day on that particular playing field.
Well, and Clint, you raised made another comment, too, that I think is very important, and I think it's an excellent one that you raised. And you know, it's not just about on the putting surface. In a case like this, and I'm going back to the fast greens. It's also around the green, chipping and pitching and things like that. You know, it's not just a matter of, you know, can I putt these fast greens, but you need to have a well-rounded game, you know, to be able to handle that. Because, if again, put in good position, maybe to have the ball below the hole, as you said, or you know, what have you, you know, I think is equally important. It's not just a matter of learning how to handle these fast greens with the putter, but you also have to be able to, you know, what's going to happen if you're a few feet off and you've got to pitch it on to a fast green. You've got to know, you know, what you're doing there in that aspect as well. So I think there's a lot of, you know, areas that people really need to focus on and not just on one area. But you're right, guys. I think, you know, going out, if you're focusing on what's in the field and what trouble may lurk around the corner or around the dog leg, if you will, then you really are setting yourself up for failure and are surely going to have difficulty throughout your round. Great answers, guys, and let's move on here. And speaking of difficulty, Scott, you had mentioned this. Ryan from Las Vegas writes in. He says, I play here in Vegas where often the air, of course, is dry and got some elevation changes here and there depending on where he's playing. And, of course, the ball tends to fly a little bit further. He says, the problem I have is making the adjustment when I play, as an example, when I go to visit friends not out in Florida, he's difficulty making the adjustment. And he gives an example. He says, for example, here he says, I might hit my 7-iron in the desert 160, but in Florida it might only fly 150. His question is, can you give me any tips or tell me how to make the change? And I think what he's trying to ask here is, you know, he plays a lot of golf, obviously, in the desert. Conditions are different than what we might play out here on the East Coast. And Ryan's difficulty is, I think, when he gets out there, it takes him a while to sort of adjust. So what are some things, Scott, let's start with you this time, some things that maybe Ryan needs to keep in mind or needs to do to when he's playing different situations like that?
Yeah, I think if he's switching back and forth often enough, one of the best things that he can do is chart his yardages with each of his clubs in each location. So if he knows he's hitting on average his 7-iron 160 in Vegas, and then he goes to Florida and let's say he goes and hits 11 of them and the average that, you know, he takes the 5 shortest and the 5 longest and we'll take that 11th ball, which is right in the middle, and take that as his average and let's say that's, you know, 153, and he does that with the majority of his clubs, I think now he's got the basis in each location to be able to go back and say, hey, I know when I go on the East Coast or I'm in heavier air or I'm not, you know, I'm not in Vegas, that I'm going to be one club or a half a club shorter under these conditions versus my home conditions. And I think knowing how far you hit each club in each situation would go a long way to helping them make that adjustment quicker.
Right. And I'm going to stop you there, Scott, only because, and you'll understand in a few moments, actually our next question is going to address that very concern. So I don't want to get too much. So Clint, let's go to you here for a second. And Brian in Vegas has this, you know, as you've heard, what are some things that we can, you know, offer some help in a way to, you know, besides what Scott's just put out there to help Ryan deal with changes in altitudes and climate and that sort of thing?
To be honest with you, I think he pretty much said what he needs to do.
Okay.
I mean, in today's world, I mean, with all the, you know, rangefinders, you know, you just go out to the range and find those, you know, find you a spot to hit it to and pay attention to how far it goes. I mean, it's not that hard, really.
Right. What about playing, as an example, maybe a different ball? And I'm just throwing that out there.
I don't know. I probably wouldn't do that. You know, I think it could very well be he just needs to park his ego when he's playing on the East Coast and not worry about hitting a 7-iron 165 yards, you know.
Right.
And play the game. Again, it comes back to what we talked about a minute ago. Play what's the day. Play the day. I mean,
right.
What's the conditions today? What I'm playing this condition and, you know, here in South Carolina in the winter, the ball doesn't go as far as it does in the summer. You know,
right.
The ground gets hard, ball bounces everywhere, you know, whatever. So you just have to play the day and what's presented to you. But if you need to have a little bit of knowledge and information, get out to the range. Shoot a couple of spots on the range, hit those irons, see how far they're going against that range, and go for it.
Right, right. I think so. Greg, if you were dealing with somebody that has this scenario, and obviously, you know, Clinton, I think Scott covered that, but, you know, there's obviously players out there that mentally kind of, you know, get challenged, if you will, in a situation like this. If you were going to advise somebody on that aspect, what suggestions would you give them to deal with a situation like that?
Sure. Yeah, no, I'm glad you gave me an opportunity to answer, Ted, because one of the probably the most important thing that I talk about in all of my coaching is the importance of playing golf with a strategy. And I'm not talking about a technical course management strategy of what clubs you're going to hit on what shots, but, you know, that while that's important, that's tactical. And the strategy that I talk about is really just a high-level thought process that's going to have you engage from the first shot to the last shot. So a perfect example of a strategy and why it matters and why every single round is very unique and every day is unique and how you feel every day is different because your physiology is different. So there's so many variables. You can go and play the exact same course 100 days in a row and you would need a different strategy every single day because how you feel on every single day is different and the situation you're playing in is different every single day. So for example, a situation where the ball is not flying as far as he's used to, maybe your really good strategy for that day is be patient or
right.
accept it, you know, because you have to basically go into the round with the mindset that is going to have you focused, motivated, but at the same time, very, very calm and confident. So knowing it's like what we talked about earlier with the really fast greens, you have to embrace it. You have to put your mind set in a place that's going to allow you to perform at your highest level. And one of the ways that you do that is take the time to figure out what kind of a strategy do I need going into today. If I'm playing in a very competitive situation against somebody who is better than me, my tendency is going to be to focus on them. So maybe your strategy for today is focus on me. If I'm playing in a situation where I know the ball is going to fly maybe a little bit less than what I'm used to, well, then you know what? You need to
right.
figure out what kind of a mindset is going to have me totally confident, even though I know I'm not going to hit the ball as far as I normally do. And coming up with a strategy takes 2 minutes sometimes. Sometimes it takes 20 minutes because you really need to sit back
yep.
and ask yourself, what is going to, number one, resonate with me from the first shot to the last shot and have me totally engaged and focused on every shot? But most importantly, what's going to give me the most confidence today? And having
right.
a strategy is it's one of the most important concepts that I teach, and it is a game changer. Because when, you know,
yeah.
golf can be a battle. And, you know, a military unit is not going to go into a battle without a strategy. So it's the same thing. You should not enter into a round of golf without a strategy because you need to make sure that you can get through every little battle that you're going to encounter over 18 holes of golf.
Yeah, and that's true. You know, I think sometimes people, you know, much like the previous question, you know, talking about fast greens and so forth, I think sometimes people put too much emphasis on, you know, conditions. I mean, obviously, you have to be, again, you have to be cognizant of conditions if you're playing in a climate, let's say, where you're getting hit with a lot of rain or what have you. You have to make adjustments, of course. But I think you're right, Greg. I think having a good strategy before you get out there, and I think, you know, as Ryan had indicated, you know, he's hitting different differences, but as Clint pointed out, you know, so what? So if you're only hitting 150 with your 7-iron that particular day, then you make adjustments accordingly that way, and that's all you're going to hit your 7-iron. Don't worry
sure.
about the distances. Just, you know, play your game. So I think that's great answers. Scott, the reason why I wanted to sort of have you halt there is you brought up actually Brian from Monterey, California asked a question, and it's kind of an interesting question because most cases it's probably not a factor, but in his case it is, and I'll read it out to you real quick, guys, and then we'll get some comments. And Scott, I'm going to start with you. Brian from Monterey says he has a real difficult time judging his distance. He says he doesn't have the benefit of owning, as Clint had put out, a pin seeker or et cetera, or on one of the other devices. He says, so he's not exactly sure how far. He says, I hit each of his clubs. He hits balls at the range, but he's not confident their markers are accurate. He would like to know how far he hits his clubs, but unsure how to go about it. So let's say, Scott, let's start with you. And, you know, let's say you are playing at a facility that obviously some of the higher-end facilities are going to be a little bit more, but maybe if he's playing at a range that doesn't necessarily keep good yardage markers accurate, you know, how does he sort of, you know, in that case, gauge how far he's hitting his clubs?
You know, that happens quite often because I know there's a couple of ranges right around me that have that very issue that the markers we know are, you know, 10, 12 yards off, 4 or 5 yards off. And so if he doesn't have like a Bushnell or Leopold or one of the other range finders that are available, you know, somebody usually on the range has one. And one of the things that I would do is I would just politely walk over. And if you know somebody's using one on the range, ask them if you could borrow it or ask them what the yardages are. You know, and aside from that, I know on the shorter clubs, which I put a big emphasis on, especially wedge play and short iron play, you know, is go find a field and go hit some balls. Go take your wedge and hit 11 shots and hit just the same swing, 11 shots, eliminate the five longest, eliminate the five shortest balls, and that 11th ball in the middle is your average, and keep track of that. And you do that with each of your clubs where you've got the room. So if you can hit your 60 and a 56, maybe a gap, and maybe your pitching wedge, and then maybe you've got room to get into your six, you know, your 7, 8, and 9 irons, I would work my way from my wedges back. And then, again, if you're on a range and you happen to be there enough and frequently enough, you know, somebody sooner or later will have one, and just ask them to borrow it and then shoot those, the signs or the flags or whatever markers are out there, or the pole at the back of the range. And then lastly, if you can't do it there, what I recommend is doing it on course and kind of keeping a record of, hey, I'm going to drop the ball at the 150 marker, and I'm going to hit my 8-iron, and I'm going to pace it off. And I might do that three or four times and get an average. Same thing with a driver. You find a straight hole where you're not really walking around flower beds or planters, or if you've got a straight line, hit some drives. And if you hit, you know, you hit the fairway or a decent enough drive, you know, pace off that driver in a round, in a practice round, or any round for that matter, and write it down and chart it, and then you can get your, start building your yardage. It's just a little slower process that way.
Right. One of the things that I, before I move on to one of the other gentlemen here, let me just throw this in here. Something that I used to do when I was growing up, when I didn't always have an opportunity to get out to the range or a course and do that, is we had a great park up the street. And I know that they didn't always like us doing that, but sometimes on a weekend when there was a ball game or something going, we had soccer fields there as well. And we used to tee it up and hit between the goalposts, because we knew they were 100 yards apart, and then pace it off from there. So there's a lot of ways that you do this, of course. Clint, let me bring you in some great advice here. So let me get you to chime in.
I couldn't add anything to what he said, but here's I prefer, unless they're at a really high-quality practice facility, okay, and knowing what kind of golf ball they're playing, I would prefer to see him go out and do that, and I prefer to see anybody do this, is to, number of ways you can do this. You on course, I want them getting yardages with the ball they intend to play with, because we all know that range balls are hot, and they're gonna go, a lot further than maybe the ball that you're playing on the course. You know, if you're playing a Pro V1 or whatever, and you're out there on the driving range hitting top flights, you're gonna have a different reaction. We know that. So on course is really the preferred, but a lot of times, if I'm, you know, working with a new wedge or something, I'll wait until either real early in the day or real late in the day and go out and take six of my golf balls and hit them on the range, you know, maybe down the side or whatever, get out of the way. If there's nobody out there, step them off. I'm old school. I don't have a range finder. Everybody I play with got one, so I just use theirs. You know, I'm cheap as I am. And so... Yeah, that's a great suggestion. Why buy one? Everybody else has got one, right? So I prefer to step it off. I'm just old school, you know?
Yeah, the Warren Buffett approach to, you know, why buy a yacht when
everybody else has got one.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, why not?
I like
I'm like you,
Clint. That's what I was getting at when, you know, we used to go up to the park. You know, we didn't always have the benefit as a youngster sometimes to get out of the course or what have you, but or cost wise. But you know, we would go up and pace it off like that. And like I said, we would use things that we knew what the distance were. You know, the soccer fields and things like that. So that helped as a guide. And you know, we knew if we hit it past there, we would pace off how many yards we went past the goalposts. And we knew that, you know, for argument's sake, if it was 50 paces past, okay, that was 150 yards because we knew that the goalposts were measured. So. You know, we would use that as a gauge. But yeah, I'm old school like you. I mean, technology is great, and if somebody's got one on there, but if they don't, you have to sort of, you know, make do. Greg, let me get you in here. I know this is kind of an odd question, but let me see if I can turn it around and get you to share some thoughts on this. You know, there's a lot of players out there that don't take the time and effort you know, to do as the other two gentlemen have suggested, you know, either stepping it off and getting the yardage and that. So if you had a student that you were working with that really didn't have a clue as to how far they hit their clubs, besides the obvious things that have already been suggested, from a you know, a head perspective, mental perspective, what would you say to them and how would you advise them to sort of work things through?
You know, it's a really good question, Ted, and I've been thinking about it as I'm listening to, you know, everybody's responses and just listening to the, you know, thinking about the question in general. And you know, nothing is really, like, glaring at me, you know, in terms of, you know, what's a great response in terms of how to maybe think a little bit differently about this. I think I'm just going to probably, you know, again, I'm like Clint, you know, I don't play with a rangefinder or anything. And I've, you know, I was playing earlier today and, you know, my brother had his on him and he goes, oh, don't you want to know your yardage? And I said, yeah, I'm 125 because you're 128. You know, so I'm, you know, I know that's not the answer that you're looking for, but I think that what you need to do is to really just, you know, let's just take this to within 50 yards. And I know that's probably not the distances that he's referring to, but go out and pace off 50 yards and then pace off 60 yards and really start to know, you know, what does 50 yards look like exactly? And you have to, you know, envision what that length is. And if, you know, you might also say, hey, you know what, if you have no clue how far a distance is, a short distance, you say, hey, you know, how far do I think I can throw a football? I think I can throw a football 40 yards. Well, I think I could reach the pin from here. Well, at least that gives you some kind of a sense in, for a very short distance. But again, talking about what Clint said, is, and I totally agree, it's, you know, it's just pace it off and start to envision what that shot looks like from 50 yards. What club do you hit? Are you hitting a 56? How high in the air does it go? And really start to ingrain that image of what a 50-yard shot and then a 60-yard and a 70-yard shot looks like so you can retain it. And then that way you can almost kind of work it in reverse and say, okay, well, what would my shot look like to get to that distance? And then you can envision what kind of a flight path it takes based on what you've hit in the past. That's just one thought that comes to mind is really, you know, work on short distances, visualize, you know, in your mind what that shot is going to look like before you even hit it and then go out and try and execute it. But you have to practice this. You know, this isn't just something you're going to go out and do on the course. It's something that you're going to do on the range, which I know what he's referring to. But you have to kind of ingrain, you know, in your mind what that shot looks like. And then, like I said, work on short distances first and then go from there.
Yeah. Great answer. You managed to come up with one anyways. Thank you very much, Greg, for doing that. Okay, guys, here's our last question. And this, funny enough, rolls right into practice. We've had some questions before, but I think this one really is one I want to tackle here. Brad from Baton Rouge, Louisiana, writes, and he says, I know that practice makes perfect, but that can get old sometimes. Clint, I'm going to start with you on this one. His question is there any way to maximize my practice time without having to spend 2 hours at the range? So if somebody wants to take it, you know, get out there and work on their game, what are some things that you would get them to do to get the biggest bang for their buck, let's say? If they're limited with time, per se, or if they have more time, how would you sort of you know, mold them into a practice routine? Let's start with you, Clint.
Well, it's real simple. They're going to have to go to the range. I'm not a big advocate of just beating balls. I hate to see the person go out on the range with two big baskets of balls because you know they're not going to get anything accomplished. He's got to go to the range with very specific purposes, a specific thing they're going to deal with. And that's where a good, you know, lesson program with a good professional can help them identify exactly what they need to work on. And I would suggest to him, buy the small bucket of balls and focus his time on each shot he's hitting on what he wants to work on. I know personally in my game when I go to the range, probably 80% of the time when I go out to the practice range to hit a few balls, I know that my biggest trouble is rhythm in my swing. So I go up there and I hit a small bucket of balls. Every shot, the only thing I'm focusing on is just rhythm of the swing. You know, so I would highly suggest that he have a very clear purpose when he steps out there, get the smallest bucket of balls, make each shot count for him, and then go practice his putting.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I think, you know, you have to practice with a purpose. And I think once you have a, you know, have something in mind that you know, that we've talked about this before, I know, and you know, I don't want to get too repetitive on it, but, you know, I think a lot of people out there, just as you indicated, Clint, you know, just go out there with, you know, two big buckets of range balls and are beating them until the cows come home, and then they wonder why their, you know, handicap isn't lowered in the last, you know, 10 years. Scott, from your perspective, how would you pretty much the same thing, or what's your routine when you go to the range and you want to work on some things? Do you have a specific routine that you have, or do you go with a specific purpose in mind, or how do you approach it? And then how would you advise a student?
Ted, we're in the golf business. We don't get to the range and we don't play. You should know that by now.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, so I don't even know what a routine on the range for myself is anymore. You know,
Let me stop you. Let me rephrase that. Let's put it as a hypothetical. How's that?
You know what? I'm playing the first round of the – first of all, this is Michigan, so we all know we get a late start anyways. I'm playing the first round of the year tomorrow. That's the funniest thing yet. So, you know, I think practicing with a purpose, has its place. But I think the other element is it – and one of the things that I love giving to my students is there's a website called Vision 54. And the books that Pia Nielsen and Lynn Marriott wrote, I think, are fantastic ways to practice, and they make practice fun. So a lot of the times, you know, aside from getting away from my routine, it's playing holes, you know, individual holes of your favorite course. Maybe it's Pebble Beach, maybe it's your home course, whatever it is. You hit a driver, the three wood off, you know, let's say the first tee, and let's say, hey, you know what, I just hit it in a divot, and you're going to throw a ball in a divot on the range, and now I'm going to play 8-iron to the green out of a divot. And you play games on the range, and you change your targets often, and you have a very focused, specific practice to where you're hitting the types of shots that you may face at a specific course, but you make it a little more fun, a little more challenging. The reason I mentioned Vision 54 is I think – from a non-technical teaching aspect, I think a lot of the things that they offer up in practice like you play, and I think it's the game before the game, I think is the other one, where the first two books that they did are fantastic ways or fantastic books to go read and then implement some of those practices that they've kind of outlined, because none of them are technical in nature. They're, you know, hitting balls off one foot, legs crossed, changing targets, hitting every single club to maybe the 150-yard mark, including your driver. And being able to be creative and kind of get off that analytical side of the mind and get to the more creative side of your mind and maximize your practice time and still have some fun. Because let's face it, we've all hit balls, and, you know, when I played, it was 1,000 balls a day, and, you know, we were working at it. It was a job.
Yeah.
But now to have fun, I mean, I'm all about let's make golf fun, let's make it an enjoyable sport and still improve and still get the things done that we need to get done as far as, you know, technical improvement. I think that's a great way to go about doing it.
Yeah, and I agree. I agree 100% with that as well. I just think that, you know, obviously you have to go with some kind of a purpose. I think if you just kind of, you know, as Clint had mentioned earlier, I think if you just kind of go there and Brad had raised a point, I think, that a lot of people fall into this trap, you know, in his comments here. He said, you know, but that kind of gets old sometimes, and he's not referring to what we're suggesting, but, you know, going, if somebody's going to go and spend time at the range, certainly if you're spending 2 hours at the range, you got a problem, because anything's going to get old after that. I mean, once in a while that might be fun, but, you know, if you're doing that on your regular as part of your regular routine, going for 2 hours to the practice range, no wonder it's getting old real quick. But, Greg, let me just get you to sort of round this out for a little bit. You know, from a mental standpoint, there's a lot of things that I think people let creep into their minds, and I think that, you know, it's not just, again, the physical part of the game, hitting good, crisp type, but there's also preparing yourself. Part of the practice is getting the mental part of the game in check as well. So what are some things and drills and things that you have people focus on in order to prepare for a great round?
So are you saying different from practice mindsets, Ted? Something totally different?
Well, yeah, you can – let's put it – sorry, let me regress here. Put it in the sense for practice, but, you know, if you want to add in there for a round as well. But let's say for practice, what are some things that you might get them to sort of prepare, you know, not so much from the physical standpoint, but from the mental standpoint?
Yeah, I'm going to just go back to this concept of playing with a strategy and playing with purpose. You know, everybody talks about practicing with purpose, but you know what you need to do, what golfers need to do, is you need to level the playing field between the range and the course. I mean, how many golfers say, oh, you know what, if I could just bring my range game to the course, I'd be a great player, or if I could just bring my pro out with me on the course, I'd be great. Well, it's none of that. It's about leveling the playing field. So what you need to do is you need to amp up your energy level when you practice, because you're typically very relaxed. But when you go play for real, you have a little bit more anxiety. And especially if you're playing in a competitive situation, you have even more anxiety or more energy. So what you want to do to level the playing field in both scenarios is, number one, is you have to have a strategy when you practice, and you have to have a strategy when you play. And a great strategy to help you practice with purpose. Think like a sniper, okay? So if you think about the sniper's mindset versus the golfer's mindset, they're totally different, but their objective is the exact same, which is to hit their target, right? But what does a golfer think about?
Right.
A golfer thinks about everything but their target. And, you know, I teach a process called 100% Ready. It's a pre-shot routine. It gets you, you know, totally in the zone, standing over the golf ball before you hit it. So as opposed to just hitting golf balls aimlessly and without any intention and without any targets or any consequences or thoughts, is to treat every shot as if it's its own, and to think like a sniper, and to not just fire randomly, but to be totally focused on that target, totally engaged, totally committed, and totally trusting, and to take your time and go through this process on every single practice shot. I have a student of mine who is a freshman. He's going to be a sophomore next year. He started coaching and working with me last October. This kid is doing something nobody in the history of the game is doing when he practices. He actually checks off every shot during practice that he's 100% ready. And what he's doing is he's hitting a third of the amount of balls of his teammates. But this kid went from shooting mid-80s last October, very, you know, number five Division III team in the country. He shot a 69 last week. And it's because he's practicing very, very deep, very deep. He's very focused and in the zone on every practice shot. So as a result, there's much less disparity when he goes out and plays for real, and he has a practice. He has a strategy every single day he goes to the golf course.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I like, you know, I like things like that. I like when somebody, you know, seeks the challenge to go out and improve themselves to that capacity. And that's a great story to have. And I'm sure it makes it very interesting for you to work with a youngster like that, who's just really new to the game in a sense. Compared to us.
Yeah, I forgot
to... You know, something else, too, that I just want to... Go ahead.
I was just going to say the operative word there, Ted, and this is what was lost in the translation, is discipline. Chris is very disciplined to go out and do this, and most golfers, even the golfers that I've coached, they're not disciplined enough to go through and go through the pre-shot routine and every shot during practice.
Yeah, and that's true. That's very evident. I know when I go up to you know, any of the ranges and I watch, and I like to observe, you know, while I'm going through my, you know, and I don't get to go up as much as Scott had indicated. I'm like probably the rest of you. I don't get to go out and play and practice as much as I used to. But, you know, when I do get the opportunities, I like to observe and see how how people are handling themselves, and unfortunately, probably 99.9% of the people there are doing what Clint had indicated, you know, before. They're just sort of, you know, got a couple of buckets that they're taking up there, and they're just beating ball after ball, and, you know, and I see the frustration level. You know, something else that I've done too, and I try to encourage people to do this, and not everybody certainly is going to do it, but you know, you can't always be practicing in perfect conditions. Now, I don't expect you to go out in the middle of a tornado or hurricane conditions, but, you know, sometimes if it's, you know, there's a good brisk wind or something, go out to the range if you've got time and practice in those conditions, because not every time that you're in the golf course are you going to have, you know, everything in check. So, you know, and go at different times of the day. You know, go earlier in the morning, as Clinda suggested, or go a little bit later in the evening, you know, towards the end of the, before the range closes, and just get some different perspectives and different ways of practicing and different conditions. You know, even go out there if it's a light rain. I mean, I don't want somebody out there if there's lightning and whatnot in the area, but, you know, you need to practice realistic conditions. If you're going out there when it's sunny and 75 all the time and there's not a breath of breeze, that's great, but not every day that you play on the golf course is going to be that way. So you need to practice, you know, in different conditions to be, in my opinion, I think a little more realistic. Any final thoughts, guys, before I let the panel go?
Well, I think we've mentioned it before too. Is that if you are practicing and you're going to practice the way you intend to play, and I know we've talked about this before earlier, is find a spot on the range that you can get an uphill and downhill lie somehow. You know, if you have to try to talk, you know, go out on the course for a little bit or find a place that you can do that, because we all hit, you know, balls on a flat tee box surface, but we all know that very few times when you're out playing on a par 4 or par 5 you're going to find that flattest surface to hit it off of. So that's, to me, that's real important as well.
Yeah, awesome.
I was just going to say in kind of a compliment to what both of you guys are saying is, if you want to improve, if you're serious about improving, you have to ask yourself two questions. Number one, what is my desire on a scale of 1 to 10, and what is my level of discipline on a scale of 1 to 10? And then you have to go out and you have to seek your discomfort zone, which is exactly what you guys are talking about. Play in adverse conditions. Give yourself bad lies. Play against guys or girls who are way better than you, and embrace it. Don't be intimidated by people who are better than you, and don't go out and practice and play the same courses all the time or practice at the same range. Seek your discomfort zone. That's the only way that you're going to truly get better, because if you're playing in a competitive tournament and it comes down to the wire and you've never been in that situation before, it's uncomfortable, and, you know, you're going to feel it. But if you're constantly seeking your discomfort zone, that, you know, like they say, and I think it's the Michelob Light commercial or whatever, you're all of a sudden your discomfort zone becomes your comfort zone, because that's what you're so used to being in. Mm-hmm. So give yourself bad lies,
guys,
and go out and practice.
I want to thank you for
– I'm sorry, Ted. I'm done.
Great way to end the panel discussion tonight. Guys, thank you very much. I know that everybody's time is valuable, so I really appreciate all of you. Scott, I know you're going to be sticking around here. But, Greg, if you want to very quickly let everybody know how they can get a hold of you again, and then, Clint, I'll let you follow up.
Sure. Yep. It's greg@theheadcoach.us. So it's greg@theheadcoach.us. And I'm very excited to announce, Ted, that I've got a mental game workshop that I'm taking on the road to Iowa, actually, Emerald Hills Golf Club on June 29th. I'm going to be in the Midwest showing golfers how to think like a sniper and hit their target. So I'm very excited to start taking my workshop on the road.
Very good. Excellent. Thank you again, Greg. I appreciate it. And Clint, certainly last but not least,
just the normal stuff. It's the R3 approach. They find us at tgmgolf.com. Look forward to hearing from them. If they got any questions, they can email us there, or they can go on Facebook at the R3 approach TGM Golf on Facebook, and we'll be more than happy to carry on the conversation with them. And, Ted, I appreciate it, and hopefully I'll see you in a month or so.
Yeah, make sure you you ring my extension this time, and don't speed past me when you see me hold my thumb out on the interstate. Guys, thank you very much. Enjoy the U.S. Open this weekend. Hopefully, obviously, the best man is going to win, but let's hope it's an exciting U.S. Open. Thanks, guys, and I appreciate you chipping in the panel, and you guys, I hope you'll come back many times. Have a great evening, guys.
Thanks, Ted. You too.
You're welcome. Okay, Scott, I see that Gary's in queue here, so just to let everybody know, finished up another great Coach's Corner panel, and joining Scott. Scott, I'm going to let you, if you don't mind, let you introduce our other guest on this evening.
I get the pleasure of introducing the illustrious Gary Tanner. So Gary Tanner is, as far as our foundation is concerned, and me personally, because Gary has become a close personal friend as well, Gary is the chairman of the Reconnect program through the American Legion in the state of Michigan. And the Reconnect program has what's called the Michigan Returning and Wounded Warrior Program. And I like Gary because he does such a fantastic job. He's a fantastic speaker. I'll let him explain his program. But Gary and I have partnered up the last 2-3 years. We've become really good friends. Our programs work together when it comes to supporting veterans and veteran families and their needs. And golf happens to be just one part of what we do. And then Gary's program kind of takes care of some other things. And I'll let him hop on and explain that part of it. But I'm very proud and very honored to have Gary as a partner, and even more so as a friend, because we've become very close. So, you know, we're very lucky to have Gary, and I really appreciate him jumping on for the hour. So I'll let you bring him on and let him explain the program a little bit.
Not a problem. Gary, welcome to Golf Talk Live.
Thanks, Ted. I'm honored to be here, and thanks, Scott. That was more than I deserve as far as the introduction goes.
You know what? You're right, Gary. I won't introduce you like that anymore.
we'll edit that part out, Scott, a little bit later. But, Gary, I appreciate it. I'm going to do things a little bit differently. Normally, you know, I go through some questions with my guest on tonight. But since, you know, Scott indicated, Gary, he's brought you on here for a specific purpose, we're going to kind of do things backwards. Scott, first off, just explain a little bit about the foundation, how that sort of came about and the purpose behind the foundation. And then, you know, Gary, I want you to sort of jump in and talk about how you guys are working together to help some of the veterans and some of the others out there.
Absolutely.
So the background is that years ago, I'm a pretty avid runner, and I was fortunate enough to run with a gentleman who was similar to Oscar Pistorius, had the carbon fiber blade, and everybody knows him as the Blade Runner, and was really impressed by his attitude just in life, and some of the challenges he had overcome. And there was an opportunity at the PGA show with Jim Estes and Penn State University. They were doing an accessible golf clinic. And I kind of made the decision, spur of the moment, said, you know what, that's something that I would love to do. And it wasn't at that time, it wasn't just focused on veterans, it was focused on anybody with a physical disability. And so I took off for the PGA show, and spent 2 days with Jim Estes, who's out of Olney Park, and the SMGA, which is the Salute Military Golf Association, and learned about the Americans with Disabilities Act, the ADA, and then spent another day working with individuals that had disabilities and the challenges and how to teach and how to become a better teacher. And then from that point, I came back and decided that I wanted to turn my focus to working with veterans. My dad was a UDT in the Navy back in the late 50s and early 60s, which you would know them now as the Navy SEALs. And we did our first barrier-breaking golf event, I believe, in the fall of 2012. And there was a gentleman that had attended that event by the name of Zach Potter. And Zach connected me with Gary. I think he called Gary from the clinic itself. When we were doing the event, we had an accessible cart there, and Zach called Gary and connected me with Gary, and then Gary and I kind of sat down for 3 hours a few weeks later. Well, it was more than a few weeks. Gary was having a foot issue at the time, if I remember correctly, but we finally got together about 6 weeks later, and Gary's program was nice enough to donate to the Energy Foundation and to the Simple World of Golf our first accessible golf cart, and then we've been paired together ever since, and that's kind of the background of the foundation.
Well, let me Gary, before I get you to chime in here, let me just very quickly read something out here right from about the foundation. This is really part of your mission statement, and I think it's important. I want the listeners to hear this to really get sort of the flavor of what it's about. And, of course, I'm talking about the Milman NRG Foundation. Of course, NRG stands for No Restrictions Golf. And it starts off really here. The Milman NRG Foundation No Restrictions Golf mission is to increase participation of people with disabilities in the game of golf while transforming lives by providing a therapeutic approach to golf by creating a program for persons of all ages, disabilities, economic backgrounds, along with inner-city youth, disadvantaged, and underprivileged youth, while assisting them with their emotional, cognitive, physical, and social development. Through the game of golf, individuals with disabilities derive health benefits that improve quality of life. And I just love that, and I wanted to read that out, Scott, because you know I think that one of the greatest gifts for those of us that are in the golf profession can do is to give back. You know, we've all been blessed in many ways, and what you're doing I think is fantastic, especially, and obviously I know you're offering it to a wide spectrum of people, but you're particularly offering it to obviously a lot of veterans, Matt, who have made so many of their own sacrifices for this great nation, and it's nice to see that you're doing something that's sort of using your skill set, if you will, to give back to these men and women in that. So, Gary, do you want to jump in here as well? I wanted to read that out before I let you
sure.
come on and do that. So, Gary, if you want to go ahead.
Sure. Well, as Scott said, I'm the chairman of the Reconnect Committee for the American Legion Department of Michigan. And the committee that, you know, was designed to kind of be more of a meet and greet and get veterans and active duty service personnel back to, you know, in contact with each other and kind of compare stories and similarities wasn't going to work here in Michigan, especially with the conflict at hand. We had to kind of revamp and rework it and turned it more into a troop and family support services committee. And mm-hmm. we provide all kinds of services. As Scott said, we provide temporary financial assistance to keep people in their homes when they're facing evictions based on hardships due to their service or
right.
upon reintegration. We also help do disability-friendly modifications to homes when they come back, should they be in a situation where they're bound to a wheelchair or they have some special needs physically. We do PTSD group retreats up at our lodge in the Upper Peninsula, and we have partnered with the Michigan Psychological Association Foundation for that. And Mackinac Island Tourism Bureau and Treetops Resort and Gaylord both came on board almost immediately when asked. And we provide all expense-paid retreat weekends for families to get some critical bonding time together once they return from their deployments or even afterwards if they're facing, you know, some special trauma or special needs or trying to readjust to their new normal situation, as you would. And so
yeah.
we've been looking for all different ways to expand our program, and adaptive sports was a natural fit. A lot of programs are starting to include equine therapy as well as ours, and they found that cognitive retraining is a critical need for veterans that are facing traumatic brain injuries, or post-traumatic stress, other issues, and they've used various forms of therapy such as light tables and games and memory-type situations. And horseback riding turned out to be one of those favorable situations where the rocking motion in the saddle actually helped the neurological healing of the brain, similar to that of the other cognitive retraining programs. And so we're hoping that golf will too. And when we met Scott through Zach and he explained this program, I said, this is a natural fit. We've got to get involved in, and we've got to get our vets out there. Because, like you said, the gift of just providing enhanced mobility, enhanced freedom, and giving them that self-confidence to be able to go out and do something they thought they never could anymore, or maybe they thought they never could and never tried
right.
golf, but this single rider cart with the pneumatic lift seat and, you know, going out with an able golfer provides them a whole new open world of enjoyment, recreation, and sports, and you can't put a price on that.
Yeah, and you know, the thing is, it is so difficult, and you know, we all, as we watch things on the news and we see about some of the difficulties with some of these veterans coming home from their deployments. Probably, I think, one of the biggest challenges, even beyond the physical challenges, and even to some degree, even the mental challenges, is just sort of a reassimilation back into society. A lot of them have a very difficult time. I know from talking to some of them that I know have a very difficult time is, you know, where do I fit in? I'm done my tour. I'm you know, I'm not going back sort of thing. I'm here now. I'm back home. You know, what do I do with myself? How do I get back into sort of daily routines? And I like that, that Scott, you've sort of stepped up with what you're doing here and able to partner with Gary and able to sort of complement one another with the foundation. So, you know, what are some of the difficult challenges that you're finding but some success with using the foundation?
Well, a lot of times, too, like you said, just that whole reintegration process is difficult. When they go on their deployment, timeline here back at home pretty much stops. You know, the family and everybody else progresses. They come back from their deployment pretty much to where they left in their own minds of their personal family timeline. And so they do feel that they don't fit in a lot of times. And so it's difficult. So this gives them an opportunity, you know, just to try to get over that depression, get over that, you know, feeling sorry for themselves or any other situation that could be holding them back. And one of the challenges we've had is just providing, you know, some other avenue other than the traditional clinical approach, because so many times, especially in light of the current scandal that's going on with the VA, I mean, there's a lot of shortcomings with the current system that's out there. But just being able to be accepted into an activity that we all perceive as normal or that we perceive as something that you do in everyday life does help that assimilation back into their normal routine or as normal, because they're never going to be normal. I mean, even if there's no combat trauma, when you go and you serve, you're indelibly changed. You're never going to be the same person when you come back. Just that's just part of the deal you make, the blank check you write. But when you have combat trauma thrown in on top of that, now you have a whole another set of dynamics that not only you deal with, but your family as well and support. And so this gives an opportunity for that entire family to participate in the same activity and really, really has helped out providing a new sense of normal behavior, normal freedom, where they can go out and just not think about their problems for a while and go out and concentrate on something that's fun and recreational and that they can enjoy with their entire family. And, you know, the peer-to-peer counseling aspect of veterans returning is why some of the veterans organizations are so important. And a lot of times the public just sees them as a place to drink and tell war stories, but it's really that peer-to-peer counseling and being understood and not having to explain yourself and not having to try to talk to someone that doesn't understand what you've been through. And by partnering with the NRG Foundation and partnering with Adaptive Sports, you know, that gives them that common ground again with their family that they might not have otherwise, because they
So you asked kind of what some of the challenges and what some of the successes have been, and I think from a success standpoint, you know, when Gary and I got together, obviously I'm probably one of the few private instructors that owns his own adaptive car, and the clinics that we do are all free. They're free to the participants, and we usually limit it to 40 to 50 participants, and it's a good mix of veterans along with just, you know, anybody that has a disability, because the foundation was based on inclusiveness. And I think the success that we've had, one of the biggest, is that we've had a number of people that have attended a clinic and said, wow, I didn't know this exists, or I didn't know there were carts available. How do I get more information? And then we can provide the information of, hey, let's call this golf course 48 hours and see if they have a golf cart, or here are the golf courses that you can go play that I know have adaptive carts. Just make sure you call ahead. So I think those are some of the great successes that we've had. We've been able to touch a lot of lives and introduce golf and the biggest component of that is the social aspect. That, you know, that when we all go out with our buddies, there's a huge social component, and that kind of goes back to what Gary was saying. I think the challenge is that our foundation faces and that Gary's program faces and a lot of others around the country is it becomes a funding issue. There's only so much grant money to go around. And I think when you look at maybe Birdies for the Brave, Phil's program, which does phenomenal work, or the Wounded Warrior program, they do phenomenal work. And then you have a small kind of segmented program like ours, it makes it really, really hard. And I think the one failure that we've had over the last 3 years is really getting a hold of a corporate sponsor. Because our clinics aren't, you know, we only do a couple a year and we want to expand it. It doesn't cost a lot to run the program, but there's equipment needs and instructors donate their time. We'd like to get somebody on board that would say, hey, look, we're going to make a 3-year, 5-year commitment. We want you to continue to do the clinics and reach out to as many people and introduce the game to as many people as you can. I think that's been our biggest challenge, to go back to answer your question.
Yeah, and
well,
also,
actually,
too, that,
go ahead.
Sorry. I was just going to say it also, too, I mean, when we started our Michigan Wounded and Returning Warrior program up, we had looked at joining the National Wounded Warrior Project and starting a chapter here, and the overhead that they have because of their media campaigns, their advertising is so high that really 30 to 40% actually gets to the veterans they serve, and the rest of it is operating the foundation, which is important because it raises the awareness on the national level
right.
in a way that we can't. However, if you're in Michigan being all Guard and Reserve, with the exception of our active duty Coast Guard, North Carolina and Michigan are the two states with the highest Guard and Reserve populations. And so for us, we started the Michigan Wounded and Returning Warrior Program because 100% of our money goes to the veterans and families we serve. We're all volunteer veterans. We do this on the side from our normal jobs. And so we rely on those private donations that Scott's talking about. We rely on, you know, the corporations that step up and say, hey, we'd like to support this. And the blessing, one of the greatest things and benefits for me with Scott's program partnering with ours is the fact that he is a 501c3. And most veterans mm-hmm. organizations, by the way that they're congressionally chartered, are 501c19. And although we're nonprofits and although we do a lot of great work, we still have the ability to lobby Congress. And so we don't qualify for those charitable donations that a lot of corporations give only to 501c3s. But with Scott's program
right.
now, that opens up a whole new avenue of possibilities for people that would like to sponsor us. And, you know, the testimonials that come back from the people that attend these clinics and the smiles. I mean, the last clinic that we had, Scott, you remember that? There was a one gentleman that I think he was pretty much homebound and hadn't been out, and he could barely grip the club. We had special gloves that they can put on so that they can hold the club. We had him on our cart. I think he hit the ball maybe 3 feet when he did hit
yeah,
it.
Yeah, maybe.
And the smile,
yeah.
the smile on that
yeah.
face when he realized that he could do something like that was unbelievable. I mean, everybody mm-hmm. in the place, if you had a dry eye, you weren't human. It was just
yeah.
incredible to see that. And it was that exact moment that it happened. I mean, it was just one of those things that this program provides. And when you see that whole new avenue open up to these people that they never knew existed, it's phenomenal.
You know, one of the things that I try to do with my program, you know, besides what we did in the first half is, you know, help with some tips and training and things like that for the average golfer, is I like to use, you know, for lack of better words, my voice, and I certainly don't profess to hear anything, but, you know, I have a lot of, you know, network capabilities in that, you know, through a lot of social media. Social media is very powerful, and I always like to find ways that I can do to give back myself, and one of the reasons why I created this program, Golf Talk Live, was really to help give a voice. There's a lot of great people like Scott out there, and, you know, as I'm listening to you, I'm thinking to myself, you know, what can I do, you know, to sort of help what it is that you're doing? And what I'm thinking of, and I'm going to throw this out there, and we'll talk about it, you know, at a later point off air, the three of us, but I'd like to maybe dedicate a specific show specifically to not only the foundation, but also, Gary, what you're doing, and just really help to create awareness for two reasons. Number one, obviously, as you do, Scott and Gary, I love golf and anything about golf.
Mm-hmm.
But I believe in giving back whenever and wherever I can. And one of the things that I've been able to do with this program is to bring a lot of people together in the golf business at the professional level and beyond and the corporate level. And I see an opportunity here really that maybe I can help in some way to maybe get some corporate dollars going your way. So if I can do anything to help, I certainly will. And I would like to maybe set aside an entire program, you know, to really talk about in more depth, you know, how we can help and what we can do and get some of the veterans that
sure.
you're working with, you know, to come on the program as well and talk about some of the benefits of that they're seeing by being involved with that. So we'll talk about that at a later point, but that's something that I think I would like to do, and I think it's important for two reasons. Number one, there's a lot of these men and women that are coming back from combat over the next year or so, and some many have already come back, and I don't want to get into a big political thing. I know, Gary, what you alluded to that's going on right now in the media, and with the VA scandal, and I just think it's terrible. My father served in World War II, and I served for a period in the Navy, and have many, many relatives that have served over the years, so I know that's very close to home with me as well. But I just think that golf has been a tool not only for business as well as pleasure, but it has been synonymous with many, many charitable organizations around the world. And I can see this being an opportunity for the golf industry and for corporate leaders to step up and say, you know what, we're going to do something to give back to these men and women that have gone and served this great nation. So this is something that I'm going to spin my wheels in my head here and see what I can do on my part to help you guys in the months coming up.
That would be incredible.
Scott, let me ask you, talk about some of the things that you're doing with the foundation, specifically if there's tournaments that you're organizing or fundraising, that type of thing. If there's things coming up, let's get the dates out there and get people active right now.
So earlier this, and I'd be remiss, we had a very active member of our foundation, and we alluded to him earlier, Zach. And we lost Zach early in this year. Zach was when I say he was the reason our foundation got to where it got to, it was solely because of Zach, not because of me or the clinics or anything else. Yeah, we did them, but Zach was the catalyst that basically pushed the Energy Foundation forward. He was at every event, and he loved it. He was a big supporter of the program, and we lost him earlier this year. And wow. Along with that, I think we kind of lost a little bit of our mojo, for lack of a better word.
Yeah. Our momentum.
Took the wind out of your sails, in other words.
It did, and you know, Zach was very close to us, probably closer to Gary than me, but then Zach and I became very, very good friends, and you know, we kind of put a few things on hold. We weren't able to secure a corporate sponsor for the May clinic, so we postponed the May clinic till September. There's only a couple of us. So Gary's busy with, like you said, we all have full-time jobs, and we volunteer our time, and so do the other instructors. So it's really hard for us to do all the fundraisers and get it because we don't have enough hands. Everybody that, you know, kind of helps out is spread very, very thin. They have other interests. So it's really difficult when you first start any company, let alone a nonprofit. So we've had our challenges. So we haven't had much planned this year, and we're kind of all trying to just regather and regroup. And I think the next clinic that we do have planned will be September 11th, although that may change because we partner, and I got Gary's program along with the golf program, Energy, involved with Treetops Resort up in Traverse City. What is it, Gaylord, Gary? Mm-hmm. Gaylord?
In Gaylord.
Yeah, sorry.
Gaylord? Okay.
It's Gaylord. It's Gaylord, Michigan. And Kevin McKinley is great, and they do the Patriot Shootout Labor Day weekend, Gary?
Yes. Yeah, in conjunction with Polls of Honor.
Yep. And which is another great organization, Dan Rooney. And so we may take the clinic on the road this year and take it up and introduce it to a whole new population. And I think you hit the nail on the head, Ted. It's one thing that we need to do is being in the golf industry is we need to grow the game by any means possible. And that means getting different demographics and different people involved that, you know, may want to play, may want to attempt the game, whether they're veterans, whether they're not veterans, it doesn't really matter. We need to grow the game because, as you know, we've been contracting for a number of years, and the numbers don't look any more promising this year than they did last. It's about 600,000 more golfers this year, you know, and with courses and the economy. And I think, you know, all we can do to grow the game, for us, it's a love of the game. It isn't about money. Like Gary said, 100% of everything that we take in either goes to purchase equipment or adaptive equipment, or another card, or pay fees just for the instructors of the course so we can do the clinics. And I think that's kind of where our program is. It's been a struggle. It's been difficult.
Do you foresee, and I don't know with the parameters, I know obviously you want to focus on your area, but are you thinking down the road of maybe doing clinics in other areas around the country?
You know what?
Expanding it, or are you...
if we could do it, I'd love to. I'll tell you who I'd like to pattern off of, believe it or not, is the SMGA. And I mentioned Jim Estes. You know, I kind of looked at Jim because they did my training. But they're going to probably mostly in the Southeast, but they do a lot with the VA and the veterans groups, and that's kind of who we'd like to pattern off. But I'd love at some point to be able to take most of my time and give back and introduce the game or reintroduce the game to the men and women that served our country that are coming back. And just like Gary said, from a PTSD standpoint, the social component of golf goes a long way to combating or at least curtailing some of the PTSD-related symptoms that we see and reintegrating our men and women back into just a regular life. Because we know they may not ever get there, but this certainly helps, and we know it. It's been proven.
Well, you know, the interesting thing, let me just quickly chime in here. The interesting thing about golf, unlike really any other sport, you know, certainly, you know, we see handicapped Olympics and things like that, and a lot of people with physical challenges have been able to do a lot of different sports. But golf is kind of a universal sport in time. But, you know, whether you, as the gentleman that you indicated earlier, you know, whether you're able to hit it 3 feet or 300 yards like a Bubba Watson, golf just has sort of it's in a unique class itself in the sense that there's always a great story every round to tell. And, you know, anything that you can do to bring these young men and women and some older, of course, that are coming back into a game, regardless of the way around the physical part, it's really the mental part that needs the most focus on, you know, whether somebody has lost a limb or multiple limbs. Golf is a type of game that you can adapt, because I know, you know, many people that are non-military that have had physical challenges that still play golf to this day, and some are up in their, you know, 60s, 70s, and beyond. So it's certainly possible, especially with technology today. So there's really no excuse from a physical standpoint. There's always a way to adapt. And, you know, the emotional aspects is huge because it's a game that, you know, you can just go out and have fun. You're not, you know, competing on the PGA or LPGA tour. You can just go out and have fun. And unlike many other sports where, you know, the physical challenges are a little harder to get over, and certainly not impossible, but a little harder to get over. Golf is something they can just go out and have a good time with. It's a great social aspect, and it's even a business tool to some. There's a lot of active, you know, military men and women that have come back that are looking to get into other ways. Golf is a tool that they can use to network with and you know, working whatever it is that they want to do when they come back from their deployments. So there's a lot of great things that we can do with golf, and you know, I'm certainly excited for your foundation and Gary for what you're doing as well. You know, if there's one way that we can kind of, you know, stir the pot a little bit with the corporate side of things, Gary, what do you think that is? What do we need to do to get the corporate world sort of more involved in something like this?
Well, Ted, I think primarily just raising awareness first and foremost is critical, that there is a need. Patients that I've approached were more than willing to help but just had never been asked or didn't know how to get involved. And so I think raising the awareness both of the need and also making it easy for them to get involved is critical. I think there's so many people pulling at their money. It's difficult. There's so many charitable causes and foundations out there that everybody wants a piece of their money. So they're very skeptical. They're very, you know, it's tough to get in there. But like you said, with golf, golf is a sport for life. I mean, you can play it pretty much up to your last breath. I mean, it's one of those great games. And like you said, with the social aspect, you play against yourself, unlike a lot of other sports. You know, you're still playing against other players when you get to the professional level, when you're all kind of even. But that's what handicap takes, you know, into account for you. And I try to tell, you know, the vets and people that we work with, they say, well, I can't play. Well, you're only playing against yourself. If you go out and you play better than you did the last time, it's a success. You won. There's no other guideline other than that. And so I think with the corporations, it's the same thing. Once we show them that their money is going to be used and it's going to be used responsibly and it's going to be used 100% and nothing is going into salaries or overhead or anything that doesn't benefit these veterans, I think they will want to come on board. And when I see groups like Scott's with this NRG Foundation, that, I mean, it's a niche that really hasn't been, I don't think it's been explored well enough, in our, especially in our state, with so many golf courses here in Michigan and even all over the country. I think it hasn't been advertised enough. I don't think it's been exploited enough to make people aware that this need exists and that we have the ability to heal using golf.
Well, and I think there's certainly, you know, I've certainly seen a lot of, you know, tournaments, fundraising tournaments, not to raise money for a lot of the soldiers and that, and that's a great thing. But I think it's just more than just, you know, raising the money to do certain things. I think it's actually engage. You know, I think they want to be engaged. They want to feel like they're doing something. And as you said before, guys, you know, there's a lot of great programs out there, and everybody's sort of competing for, you know, part of that pie. And as you said, I believe, Gary, you know, a lot of the corporations are, some haven't been approached, and ones that have been approached probably have been approached by several. So they're unsure and maybe even a little skeptical of how to, you know, how to do things and you know, be able to pitch in and help. So certainly awareness, I think, is the number one thing that needs to be done. And with so many, you know, of the veterans coming home in recent years and years to come, it's going to be more and more needs to be moved to the forefront, because there's going to be a heck part, in my opinion, for the PGA to really step, and the LPGA, of course, to step up and address this openly, because I think once they do and sort of, you know, gravitate around this issue, you know, I think some of the corporate dollars will start to loosen up a little bit, and maybe some of them will jump on board. But, you know, guys, as I said, I certainly will do anything that I can to help in any way with my program you know, beyond, you know, just, you just need to ask and let me know how I can help. So, but we'll talk about that, you know, as I said, a little bit later down the road. But Scott, I want to ask you, you know, you do a lot of work, obviously, with some of the veterans and things that, and helping them over some of the physical challenges. Obviously, there's a lot of modifications that have to be made from time to time. What do you try to do to, you know, encourage those that you're working with that have some physical challenges? What do you try to do to encourage them to sort of keep moving on?
You know, it's almost touches based on one of the questions we had in the earlier segment, is getting out of your comfort zone. And one gentleman in particular that I remember, he is a below knee amputee, and he was a non-veteran. And he came to me. He had been a big avid golfer, single-digit handicap, but he had not touched his clubs since he lost his leg. And it happened to have been his left leg. It was his lead leg. And so he was afraid to transfer weight to that left side. And so what challenges me and what I love about what I do is it challenges me as an instructor, because it's unconventional. It kind of bucks the system of a traditional, you know, swing plane, right, all the things that you and I talk about and we've been taught as far as the golf swing goes. Right now, you've got to figure out a way to get this individual, by any means possible, to hit the ball and get results and do it around a disability that he's very fearful of. So what we did, and it's kind of like, remember the old drill tag where you put the golf ball underneath the right foot to get off that right side and kind of get the weight going to the side of the foot a little bit, right? So we did it in a slow step, and we just folded up a scorecard and stuck it underneath the outside of his right foot and just gradually started increasing it to get him comfortable. And it took us a while. It took us more than, you know, 2 or 3 hours of just little increments. But eventually, when he started feeling comfortable, we got him to be able to basically do the Gary Player drill, where he would hit a shot, and it's pretty common, and he would step through, and then he would have all his weight on his left side until he was comfortable. But we weren't going to progress until he did. But it goes to show you that, A, it challenges me as an instructor, but, two, when you see that, like any golf, like it's like dealing with any golfer out there, all of a sudden the light bulb clicked on, and he says, wait a minute, I can do this. It isn't so bad. I don't have to be afraid of my leg. And then all of a sudden he's doing the step through drill, and he's just hitting it out there 200 yards without any problem. And you hit that milestone, that's what it's about for us. That's where you seem to get the most excited when I teach.
Well, and you know, what? Just let me add to that. You know, what amazes me is when you get an individual like that who, you know, has some challenges to overcome, and they're willing to put the time and the effort in, and obviously, you know, it's going to take time, but they see results. and then you see somebody that you know is been very fortunate and blessed and doesn't have the same physical challenges to get over, you know, not really putting that effort in, it just goes to show you that, you know, that these men and women, you know, they're cut above the rest. You know, they've been trained in such a way that they don't give up, because giving mm-hmm. up is not an option for them.
Very true.
And
great point.
You know what I'm saying? They don't have a choice. When they're out in a combat situation, it's not, well, you know, I don't think I can do another hour of this. They don't have a choice. You know, they have to put in the time and the effort to be trained properly, and that training is extremely important to the task that they're going to be faced with. So, you know, this is why I think, Scott, you probably see so many of the you know, the students that you're working with that are in that situation are willing to put in that extra time and effort, because they know that they have to do that. They've been trained that way in the past to prepare for combat, and it's ingrained in their psyche, if you will. So it's now carried over and you know, into teaching them now how to play golf or how to replay golf, if you will, depending on the circumstances. So I think it's fantastic, and I love, to me, this is what gets me excited about golf, is there's so many things that you can do. Sorry, Gary?
I was just going to say, too, just real quick on that point, like you were saying with the training, I mean, one of our ethos in the military, I mean, is to improvise, adapt, and overcome. And that speaks to Scott's mm-hmm. point perfectly of, you know, as a teacher, trying to improvise, come those disabilities, and to provide that outlet. And like you said, there's, you know, we don't leave anybody behind on the field of battle, and we don't leave anybody behind afterwards either. And that's also ingrained in us, you know, to be there for each other and to make sure that, you know, if they're having a problem, we're going to be there to help them. And this program, you know, when I've watched the veterans that we've brought to this program work with Scott, I mean, we are so fortunate to have Scott as the instructor for this program, because he is so eager to take on those challenges and those disabilities. And he is very, very good at communicating in a way that is encouraging, it's empowering, and it's also mm-hmm. easy to understand for people that aren't in that golf world all the time. And he can communicate right. little techniques and changes. And, I mean, he's improved my game just from the bit that we've watched, you know, working with disabled golfers and helping out, and the little tips he's given me and my sons. And but he's able to communicate in such a way that it encourages them to try harder and makes them feel that this is possible, it's easy. And to teach somebody what Scott does and make them think that it's easy is a gift. And Scott's got that
yeah.
gift. And that's why I think it's so important with what he's doing and what this foundation is all about, because not everybody can do what he does. And so we have to support him in that.
Right. And that's so true. I mean, regardless, you know, I'm an instructor as well, and Scott's an instructor, and the other coaches that were on earlier are all in it. But not everybody is you know, equipped to handle maybe what Scott's doing and vice versa. So, you know, you have to play, if you will, where your strengths are. And Scott, obviously, you know, it sounds that this is a certainly a strength in your corner. And, you know, it's a gift that you've been given to not just teach golf, but to be able to work, you know, with this type of challenge. And it's not something that any, you know, you can just sort of randomly pick any instructor and say, okay, here, go out and do that, because not every instructor is going to be as successful as you are doing at it. That doesn't mean they're not an accomplished instructor or that they don't have the skill set. It's just that for this particular skill set, it's a very unique, it's just much like a guidance counselor, if you will. You know, not everybody can be a guidance counselor, you know, or a psychiatrist or what have you. It takes a certain skill set, and not everybody's cut out to do that. So that's a great accomplishment and something to certainly be proud of. And I'm glad, Scott, that you're putting it to great use like that. Guys, let me just, you know, if I can, if there was a message that you want to get out, you know, to the listeners tonight, and Scott, I'm going to let you start off, and then Gary, certainly want you to add some thoughts and comments as well. But if there's one sort of thought that you want or comment that you want to get out there to the listeners, just to you know, help with the awareness, what would that be?
That if you are an individual that has a disability, that there are a plethora of tools out there that can help you play the game. And if you're, you know, you're a son and your father is up there in age and can't walk the golf cart, there's a cart available for you. It may take some digging, it may take a little work, and not every area has them. But if you do a little bit of digging, or if you want to contact me, you know, we'll find an area that you can go play.
Mm-hmm.
And these carts are available to go on the tee boxes and the green complexes. And it's our job, if a golf course says, hey, we're not putting a cart on our green, it's our job, you know, in growing the game to explain to a head professional that may not be aware of what these carts can and can't do or should or shouldn't do. It's our job to train the individual running the cart on how to properly use it on a green in the tee box. But if you want to play the game of golf and you are capable of holding a club and swinging a club, and like you said, even if you hit it 3 feet, we're there to help, and you can play. There's tools and resources out there, and there are a lot of them out there, and there's a lot of organizations, and I'm happy to share those with anybody that wants to contact me later on. And you can contact me through norestrictionsgolf.org and just shoot me an email, and we'll get you those resources. But I think the biggest thing is that we want to convey that there are tools out there to help you play this game, whether you're an amputee, whether you suffer from a PTSD-related illness or any other disability. If you want to get out and enjoy the game, we can get you out there, and we want to see you out there.
Well said. Gary, any thoughts that you want to add to that?
I think just to kind of piggyback on what Scott said, I mean, as when you come back, like I said, because of Michigan being a unique Guard and Reserve state,
mm-hmm.
Most of these veterans – are dropped back off into the communities, and they don't have that military base structure to draw from. So organizations like the American Legion and the Michigan Wounded and Returning Warrior Program and the No Restrictions Golf Foundation and organizations that are there to provide assistance, those things are there. And the hardest thing sometimes to realize is when you ask for help, asking for help is not a sign of weakness. Sometimes asking for help is the most courageous thing you can do. And so don't be
yeah.
afraid to ask for help. Don't be afraid to reach out, because contrary to a lot of myths and a lot of stigmas that are attached to military service and military training, you know, asking for help is a sign of strength, not a sign of weakness.
That's right. I agree wholeheartedly. I can say from personal experience that when I went through my basic training, it was probably some of the best training that I ever received in my life, and I went in at
mm-hmm.
17. And I can tell you, looking back, that was probably the most enjoyable part of the. And I'm not trying to take away that, you know, the other skill sets that I was taught, but that was some of the most enjoyable time that I had, because it did two things. It taught me a lot about myself, what my limitations were, of course, but you had to work together as a team through a lot of the challenges that, you know, we were put through. And
mm-hmm.
you really developed some very strong bonds, as I'm sure many of your warriors that you're dealing with can attest to. And,
sure.
you know, I look back now, I remember when I came back from doing my time in service, and, you know, I looked at the things that I had learned and that I was taught, and I looked at some of the people that, you know, were still sort of in my age group that I went to school with and that, and it was almost like time had stood still for them. They were the same as when I left them, you know, 5 years before. And when I came back, I was an entirely different person. And, and of course, for the better. So, you know, what a great thing. And guys, I'm glad that you're sharing this with the audience. And you know, Gary and Scott, please keep doing this. And as I said, I'll reach out to you in the next few weeks, and maybe we'll do a conference call and see what I can do to help in any way to help, you know, what you're doing here. But Scott, I want to ask you before I sort of back to the golf here really quickly, if I might. I had some other questions, but I wanted to give you, you know, a little more time to really talk about the foundation and what you're doing here. But if you had your pick of any golfer in the world, present or past, to work with, who would it be and why?
Wow, great question.
Well, I thought I would save that. I actually asked that. Before you answer, I actually asked that to my guest the previous week, and I think it's one I'm going to keep for a little while and throw into my guest because I think it's kind of interesting. And just get everybody's perspective. I won't tell you what his answers were, but anyways, if you had an opportunity to work
two?
With somebody.
Wait, do I get two? I've got two.
Yeah, you can have two, and it doesn't have to be in any particular order.
We're going to go way, way back. So without question, Bobby Jones would be first and foremost. But and that needs no explanation on why. I think what he did, what he achieved with the equipment and the time frame and what he accomplished in the game, I think is phenomenal. But then I think Hogan post-accident. And I think you know the obvious why.
Right.
I think Hogan being a great player both before and then after, I think learning from, you know, his mindset and what it took and the changes that he needed to make and the adaptation, I think it would definitely be Hogan post-accident for the obvious reasons as well. I think those would be my two choices right off the bat.
Very interesting. Let me ask you, actually, that sort of intrigued me a little bit that was your answer. Not Bobby Jones, that's obviously a given, but Hogan. And I wonder, do you ever use Hogan as an example, even though, you know, his accident was not, you know, as a result of being in a military combat, but, you know, it was well documented. It was a serious injuries. It almost looked for quite some time that he may have never walked again. Do you ever use him as an example when you're talking to some of the individuals that you're working with and saying, you know, here's a great golfer, Ben Hogan. Here's what he went through and what he was able to overcome, and here's how he did it and so on. Do you ever use him as an example?
You know, that's an interesting question, and honestly, I don't. Most of the time when we're doing clinics, we're really focused on the individual, or at least I'm focused on the individual that I'm working with. And we're, you know, sometimes it takes us quite a while to find something that works, and sometimes the frustration levels build and we need to take a step back and kind of explain, you know, it takes time. But I don't think I've ever really gone back, maybe once or twice, to somebody that was a really good golfer or a knowledgeable golfer and knew the history of golf and kind of what Hogan went through. But I think most of the time when we're doing clinics or I'm working with individuals one-on-one, we're staying pretty present tense. But so I think that's a great question, honestly.
Yeah, but thanks. I'm going to steal that one. I'm going to steal that one going forward for sure.
Well, the reason why I say that, Scott, is it might be, you know, maybe to, you know, I know you know the story, but maybe to research a little bit and get some of the, you know, the facts together, it might be an interesting, you know, tale to share with some of the people that you're working with. You know, some of them may not know or may not be that familiar with Hogan, but to share his story, you know, through that period and what he went through and how he overcame it, might offer some inspiration to some of these, you know, to say that here's somebody who was really one of the greatest golfers that ever lived, went through a life-changing set of circumstances, but rose above it, and you know, it might be something to consider. I mean, obviously, I know you've got things well taken care of, but it might be something to consider to share that information with some of the people that you're working with, because I think that they could draw from that.
I think you just got my next blog post scheduled. That thing. I think we're gonna. You know what? I think that's a fantastic idea, and I honestly want to thank you. And I think you'll see that. I think we'll start. You know, I think maybe that's a great way to convey some of the things that, you know, some of the challenges that we face, and maybe coming up with a story and using Hogan because it's golf related is a great way to go. And I'll say thank you for that. And I think you'll see that coming up.
Well, anything I can do to help, you know, I'm certainly there. Gentlemen, I want to thank both of you for coming on this evening. And Scott, I'm going to give you just a few moments here to talk about the, you know, your organization, the Simple World of Golf. I know that you've got that as well. And I apologize we didn't get too much around that. I'll have you back on and we'll talk a little bit more about that. But I knew that the other was certainly, you know, a big priority for you, and you managed to get Gary to come on to join you here in that. And I really wanted to give you, you know, sort of the lion's share of time to talk about that because I think it's an important issue. But if you want to talk a little bit about some of the things that you're doing at Simple World of Golf, and then we'll close out the program.
Well, this is more about the Energy Foundation. Obviously, through the Simple World of Golf, We're doing regular golf instruction, juniors all the way through advanced players, and that's kind of, you know, the fun part of the teaching and the more technical aspect where we're working with the juniors and beginner golfers and really trying to grow the game there. I think more importantly, for me, it's raising awareness about the foundation and getting the word out and getting as many people involved in the game as we can. And one of the ways that you can help and get more information about the foundation, if I may, is you can go to www.norestrictionsgolf.org. You can certainly shoot us an email through there. You can volunteer. You can see some of the programs and things that we've done. One of the things that we did, Ted, is that through our program, we collected well over 300, maybe 200. I don't want to overstate the number. I know it's 200 for sure, that we donated 200 golf clubs to the Volunteers of America that went to, they did a displaced veterans housing facility here in the city of Detroit, and we were able to donate sets of clubs and 200 clubs to them. So we're very proud of some of the things that we're able to do, and that's through the help of the generosity of individuals that said, hey, I've got some old clubs. Would you like them? Can you use them? And all that information can be found on our website, as well, and they can see pictures of the cart that Gary's program had so graciously donated to us. And so I think ultimately, I think my message is, you know, one, I'd like to thank you and all the men and women that have served, and certainly Gary and everybody that we work with for their service to our country. And the one thing that I don't think gets mentioned enough is I'd also like to say thank you to their families, because the family sacrifice just as much, if not more, and sometimes I think it's harder on the families, and Gary can certainly attest to that, because obviously when you're away and you're in combat or you're doing your job, it's a little bit easier, I think, at times. But I don't think we thank the families enough, and I personally want to thank all of the military families out there that have given for our country as well. And I think ultimately, you know, we're just trying to do our little piece, and I think we're doing a pretty good job. I just think we could do more, and I'll let Gary kind of touch base on his program a little bit, and if that's okay.
Sure. Yeah. By all means, Gary, go ahead.
All right. And, you know, like Scott was saying, I mean, just the families being involved is huge, and it helps that bonding process. And programs like, you know, the golf clinics, the barrier breaking golf clinics, and places like Treetops and Kevin McKinley's staff also provide that family an opportunity to have the caretakers be taken care of while their person, their loved one, is out experiencing the no restrictions golf, barrier breaking golf clinics. So it provides healing on a bunch of different levels. And our program, we just want to say thank you any way we can as well, and provide any sense of normalcy to that reintegration process for our men and women who serve and their families. And like Scott said, thank you for your service too, Ted, and as a fellow veteran, thank you from the bottom of my heart.
Thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity to share our message on your show, and we look forward to working with you again in the future.
Well, gentlemen, let me just say it's certainly my honor to have you on here, and, you know, I obviously love to talk golf, but I think there's also a time as well to reflect and look at ways that we can help grow the game and do things to help those out there that have really, you know, gone that extra mile, if you will, to help protect and serve, you know, for their country. And I think it's important, you know, that nobody should be forgotten. And I'm glad and happy to do anything that I can to help. Scott, what I'm going to ask, one final thing that you can do for me in the next little while, is maybe send me an email with a schedule of maybe some of the upcoming clinics, and I'll make a point of mentioning them on the program. And anything that you've got going on, just feel free at any time. Gary, you as well. If there's things that you guys are doing, you know, you can shoot me an email. And Gary, you probably don't have mine, so Scott, if you can provide that to Gary. And I will reach out to the two of you in the next couple of weeks, and maybe we'll do a three-way call here and talk about maybe some things that I can do with the program to help raise some awareness. And that's my young lady, my nice automated young lady, telling me that it's time to get off. So,
all right. Well, thanks again, Ted, for the opportunity. It's been an honor and a pleasure.
As always, Ted, thanks. I love being on your show, and thanks again. I really appreciate it.